The title that was given on the bulletin board and the title that I gave to Norm is perhaps a little bit misleading, because I really am not going to talk too much about the geology of Holden, in the sense that if you're interested in rocks and minerals, you're probably going to be disappointed, because the geology around here is very complex, even to a geologist. And I'm sure most of you aren't very much interested in gneisses and schists and andesites and granites and things like this. So fundamentally, I'm going to talk more about the geology that's visible to you and the things you can see, and a little bit about how it came to be, and approach it from that standpoint, and try to keep it in, I hope, fairly simplistic and realistic terms, in the sense of telling you a little bit about the geology of this particular area. Most of this is going to be through slides. I have long been a firm believer in slides, and I think it's much easier for you to see things and for me to explain things if we're all looking at the same thing. So with that in mind, I'll commence with the first slide. And please, if you have any questions as we go along, wave your arm. I'll try to leave a little time at the end of the session to answer questions that you might have. But if you have some question as we travel, why wave your arm and I'll try to pick you out of the dark and answer the question as we go. The geology of the Holden area basically is one of glaciers. This region has been extensively glaciated, and most of what we see as superficial kinds of things are the result of that glacial activity. Now, this is not a glacier that's in this valley at the present time. This is a little glacier that's over the mountains. South Cascade. We'll notice in here there are two very definite parts to the glacier. There's a part that goes from here back to the upper end. This is the what we call the fern line of the glacier. All that light-colored material is last year's snowfall sitting on top of the glacier surface. The gray part that's down in the lower part of the glacier is all bare ice. And in order for a glacier to exist, it has to be in an area where the snow and ice are going to accumulate to a greater volume than what is going to melt in the summer. And when that happens, and then when the ice piles up to enough thickness, then we have a glacier, because at that point then the snow and ice will start to move a little bit. So South Cascade Glacier makes a good example of just exactly what happens here. The glacier is active enough so that it extends beyond the actual limit of where the snow is going to melt. Most of you who live in Washington are familiar with the term snow line, which is what this limit is sometimes called, although most of you hear it as a place to call the road service to find out if the roads are any good. To a geologist, a snow line is a place where the snow commences on the side of the hill or on a glacial surface. So at any rate, the South Cascade Glacier makes a good example of that. So the area above here then is the accumulation zone for the glacier, and it will, the snow and ice will pile up and then flow out beyond that. Glacier is in a sense like a gigantic file. The ice tends to pick up rocks, and the rocks are embedded in the ice, and the ice then moves along, and it's just like a file or sandpaper. What the rocks are and how big the glacier is determines what kind of sandpaper it is, whether it's sandpaper that's going to be fairly smooth and make a nice finish on the rocks, or whether it's something that's going to really scrape them down. Here you can see right below the end of a glacier, some of the rocks that have been polished and scraped down by the glacier as it was flowing, and now that the glacier has moved back a little bit, why some of those rocks are exposed, and you can begin to pick out the striations and polish and some of the surface material. Here are some also that are or have been scraped and polished, and in this case the rocks are hard and the material the glacier was carrying was relatively soft, so the rocks are more smooth and polished down rather than scraped and grooved like they are in other areas. If you travel around the mountains in Washington, you'll probably see lots of places where this has happened. In fact, if you keep your eyes open traveling between here and the boat dock, you'll probably see some places along the edge where the rocks have been scraped and smoothed down by the glaciers that came down this valley. This doesn't happen to be here in the valley, but it's quite typical of a lot of the glacial materials that we see throughout this part of Washington. The North Cascades have roughly 80% of all the glaciers in the lower 48 states. This is a tremendous amount of glacial ice, so we of course don't hold a candle to Alaska, but in terms of what we find in the continental United States, it's a very substantial amount. And here we're looking across the North Cascades toward Mount Baker and Mount Shuckson. Mount Baker is the higher volcanic peak here. And you can see some of the fairly large glaciers. Now these are what we call cirque glaciers. A cirque is a basin where the snow and ice accumulates. And as the snow and ice piles up, it gradually begins to work its way back into the mountain by shattering the rocks. And the result is a very sort of an amphitheater-shaped basin from which the mountain glaciers tend to flow. And we see literally hundreds and hundreds of these throughout the North Cascades. In fact, you'll see them almost every place in the western states where the mountains are relatively high because they're a very common landform. When the glaciers begin to move, they flow well, with varying rates. There's no such thing as an average rate of flow. A glacier might move a few inches a day, it might move a few feet a day. There are a lot of different variations and a lot of different things that control the movement. But the upper, let's say 100 feet or so of the glacier is quite brittle. And the lower part is inclined to be much more plastic. But as that plastic material flows along, it causes that brittle upper surface to begin to break up. And especially if there's some kind of stress put on the surface of the ice. And the result is what we call crevasses. And here you can see a whole series of crevasses going across the glacier surface of a small mountain glacier just a little ways north of here. Primarily the pressure and then also the fact that it is more compact ice. The upper part of the glacier, the snow is still really pretty much snow and in the transition stage between snow and ice, so it's more inclined to be a little bit brittle. But basically it appears to be the pressure that has a lot to do with that change that occurs in the lower part of the glacier. Crevasses, as I say, are usually about 100 feet deep. Again, they'll vary a little bit. They are areas to be very cautious of if you happen to be somebody who gets a chance to climb around on a glacier, because even though it's only 100 feet down to the bottom of a crevasse, it's still a fair distance to fall. So one has to be pretty aware of what's going on. Crevasses also tend to form at right angles to whatever the direction of stress happens to be. The ones you saw in the previous picture, let me go back a second, are mostly running directly across the glacier because the ice is being stretched down glacier or being pulled downstream, however you prefer to look at it. here's the terminus of a small glacier, and you can see here the crevasses are running along the length of the glacier because at this point the ice is starting to spread out a little bit. So they have a lot of different directional patterns that they can take depending on what happens to occur in the glacier. In most of the mountain glaciers, like we see around this area, there is also one very large crevasse that occurs at the very upper end of the Cirque Basin. Here you can see it as kind of a dark crack that goes along here. This is called a bergschrund. And the bergschrund is where we think the glacier tends to do most of the excavating that it does into a mountainside, as the bergschrund doesn't have the controls of depth that, say, an ordinary crevasse would have. It may be hundreds of feet deep, and this is where the frost shattering and the erosion seems to take place for the most part, that allows the glacier to gradually cut back into a mountainside. Most of the time we don't see these until very late in the season. This was taken in September a few years ago, and ordinarily if you were to go up much earlier than that, you probably wouldn't see the bergschrund because it would be covered with some of last year's snowfall. Even though it would still be underneath a blanket of snow, it wouldn't be apparent on the surface like the one here. Now, a couple of comments about erosion by glaciers. I think probably more than any other single agent of erosion, glaciers leave a very distinctive fingerprint or imprint on the areas where they have been, especially the alpine glaciers. And once an area has been glaciated, it's almost commonplace to walk up and glance at a mountain and say, gee, that mountain's been glaciated, because we can see these very distinctive landforms there that have resulted from the glaciation. Ice doesn't have the controls that, say, a stream does, so it tends to shape the land in a much different way. Here you can see an area where the glaciers have occupied a land, a large region, and they're cutting back into a central peak. And then there is another large glacier coming down the front of the mountain range here. You can see it, we'll assume it's running from right to left. The peak that's left as a centerpiece is referred to as a horn. Now, the term horn, of course, really derives its name from the Matterhorn, which is one of the famous Swiss mountains. And the Matterhorn is a classic horn. Not all horns look like the Matterhorn, although that would be an ideal shape. But most of the time, they just end up as a fairly high central peak. There are very narrow, sharp ridges that run along the edge that we call arêtes. And incidentally, if you do crossword puzzles, you find all kinds of nice glacial terminology in crossword puzzles. If you ever need a nice name, five letters for a mountain ridge, well, I use the term arête, A-R-E-T-E, and it really works wonders. Or if you need a mountain pass, try the term col, C-O-L, or you know, a lot of things like this that come from Swiss glacial terminology. Back here you can see some of the Cirque basins that resulted from the glacial erosion. And then down here in the foreground, because glaciers have a tendency to erode depending on their size, they don't erode the valleys on an even keel. In other words, the bigger the glacier, the more rapidly it can deepen or erode the valley in which it flows. Now, streams don't do this. When you look at stream systems, you'll find that a small stream will come into a larger stream at the same elevation as the large stream. It just runs right in. Once in a great while, there might be a little bit of variation, but not normally. But this is not true with glaciers. The big glacier cuts its valley very deep. The small glaciers coming in from the side aren't able to cut that rapidly because they're not big enough. And consequently, when the glaciers are gone, we have the strange phenomenon of what we call hanging valleys. The tributary valleys enter the main valley from a level that's way up on the side of the primary valley. So it makes substantial difference in the appearance. Glaciers in the Cascades and in this area obviously have changed considerably over the years. This is again a small valley glacier in the just over the hill from here a ways. You can see the Cirque Basin here. The glacier comes down, it stops right here. It has a very small accumulation basin that's left anymore. And the light-colored line up along the edge here marks the area where the glacier has been in past years, but is no longer. We call it a trim line. It just simply tells us the glacier has been much bigger in past years than it is at the present, and has shrunk down considerably, and will probably continue to do so for quite a period of time. A lot of the glaciers in the Cascades have disappeared entirely. They're just they've gone now to the point where the snowfall is not persistent enough to keep it there, and so it's gradually disappeared. This is a typical small Cirque glacier. This was again at one time a much bigger glacier than it is now. Now it's reduced to just simply occupying the Cirque basin from which it originally flowed. Most of these now seem to be fairly stable, but most of the valley glaciers, the smaller valley glaciers, have gradually receded and then ultimately sort of disappeared. Now, looking at some of the alpine terrain, the little sharp-pointed peak you see here is a typical horn. It has cirques cutting in on three or four sides, and as they cut back toward each other, they gradually isolate the central part of the peak, and this becomes a very sharp-pointed little feature, which is the horn. The sharp ridges you see going out from the horn then are the arêtes. The arêtes can be rather knife-edged or sawtooth. It kind of depends on what the rock materials are like, but they do protrude on out into the away from the horn. Actually, the arête may go on for quite a distance through the mountains, and it may include several horns as you go along. And then, of course, you can see the little amphitheaters in here that make up the Cirque basins. So it's a very distinctive kind of terrain, and something that is quite easy to recognize if you look into the mountains. Well, here we are looking at the backside of Copper Peak. Copper Peak is a big peak that's almost directly in back of the village here. And if you were to hike up the Lyman Lake Trail or Heart Lake Trail, you would get this view looking back toward Copper Peak. A beautiful example of a what? Cirque. Okay, there's a very spectacular cirque right in here. Nice, a small one, but still well formed. But what's the peak itself? It's a small horn. The crest is a typical arête. So it doesn't look quite like that from here, but once you get around and get a little bit different view of it, why, it's quite apparently a glacially formed peak. Looking across the North Cascades, these have been called the Alps of North America, and I guess one couldn't argue too much about it. They're not as high, but they certainly have many of the spectacular glacial features. Virtually everything you see here consists of horns and arêtes and cirques, and the typical glacial terrain. It's better viewed perhaps from the air as this was taken, but if you can get up on some of the high spots, why, it's certainly a fantastic view to look off across the Cascades and pick up some of the glacial terrain. This is Heart Lake. Heart Lake is a little glacial basin. Actually, it's part of a Cirque basin, and the lake itself is in a little glacially scoured part of the valley, and then it's been dammed partially by some glacial deposits, and then partially by a rather resistant rock ledge that forms this area right in here. As you walk up to it, you'll you'll see some of that barrier where the falls are at the very bottom end of the Heart Lake area. But it's really a typical glacial valley and glacial cirque basin. Glaciers also tend to carve very distinctive valleys. We call them U-shaped valleys. The valley doesn't look like a stream valley. A stream valley cuts a valley that's essentially V-shaped. The stream is the bottom, and the stream then is a conveyor belt, and it hauls everything away. The glacier is not like this. A glacier may fill a valley up to a certain level, and it scours the whole valley to whatever depth it happens to be. And the result is it makes a very distinctive U-shaped kind of valley, and especially so if after the glacier has receded, the valley isn't occupied by a large stream, which will, of course, tend to reshape it or remodel it a little bit. Here's, again, one a little ways north of us here, and you can see the nice U-shape that it has. It has a very small stream in it at the present time, and judging from the shape of the valley, it looks like the glacier was probably up to maybe about right in here someplace. Usually we can get some idea of the depth of the ice by looking at the shape of the valley and then trying to pick out the place where the shape seems to change a little bit, and that gives us at least a rough idea of how deep the ice might have been. Here's another glacial valley, this one right at the head of Lake Chelan coming down towards Stehekin. In fact, this is where the Stehekin River begins. And you can again see the nice U-shape of the valley going on down below. If you've ever been over the North Cascades, this is looking from the Washington Pass area down early Winters Creek. And again, a typical U-shaped valley. So the valley shape depends very much on how big the glacier was and how large the or how resistant the rocks are. Some valleys are kind of broad and open, and others are very very sharply U-shaped, like some of these you're seeing. Well, okay, so we're back to Railroad Creek. This is looking down Railroad Creek, and you can see the tailings way off in the distance there just before we go around the bend. Probably one of the prettiest U-shaped valleys or glacial valleys you'd ever want to see. From here, it doesn't look like this. It's hard to see. You're kind of down in the trees, but once you get up, either going up the Heart Lake or the Holden Lake Trail, then you get up a little bit above the bottom of the valley, and it immediately shows up as a spectacular U-shaped valley, really going all the way down to Lake Chelan, but not quite this obvious all the way. Lake Chelan is a glacial valley. Lake Chelan is what we would call a finger lake. The finger lakes get their name from some of the lakes in upper New York State, where there are a whole series of lakes that are kind of parallel to each other, and they occupy rather long, narrow valleys. And they were termed finger lakes because originally people thought that they looked sort of like the splayed out fingers of somebody's hand. Well, that's what Lake Chelan is. It's a finger lake. In a sense, it looks like a fjord because it's so long and deep, and it really resembles more, I think, some of the fjords like we see along the northern coast of British Columbia or Alaska or Norway or some of the Scandinavian countries. But it's not a fjord, it's just simply a lake that's occupying a scoured out glacial basin. As I recall, it's about 1,500 feet deep, and then it's dammed at the lower end mostly by glacial deposits. So it's a very spectacular lake in terms of depth and size both. But again, perhaps a little bit of an atypical kind of glacial valley because it does have such a large body of water in it, and that's not particularly common. And most of the time we'll find that the lakes that are at the heads of glacial valleys, in other words, the lakes that are in the cirques, are in a small scour basin also within that cirque. And this is what we call a cirque lake, or if you're, again, if you're a crossword puzzle buff, you'll find it called a tarn. Crossword puzzle folks call all mountain lakes tarns. Now, that's not really true, but anyway, if you need a four-letter word for a mountain lake, why, try T-A-R-N. It'll do wonders for you. But anyway, most of our so-called Cascade Lakes, the Alpine Lakes, are really tarn lakes, or they are like Heart Lake. They're in some of the small scour basins that were formed by the glaciers coming down. Lyman Lake would be a more typical tarn. So would Holden Lake. Holden Lake sits right in the cirque and is a cirque basin lake or tarn, and then the glacier came on out from there. Now, the glaciers that were originally in this basin, of course, are way back up on Bonanza Peak now, but at one time the glaciers very much occupied this valley. Here's a kind of an all-seeing view of the area. We're looking toward Bonanza Peak up here, and you can see Holden Lake down in the corner here and Heart Lake over in here. So there were two separate glacial systems, one coming down the valley this way, another one coming out of the Holden Lake area. Mary Green Glacier, of course, is the one that's kind of the remnant now of what formerly the big Cirque Glacier that occupied the Holden Basin, or Holden Lake Basin, but now it's, as you can see, moved way back up on the hillside, so it's no longer quite so obvious. Here's a classic Hanging Valley. Well, maybe not quite as classic as some of those in Yosemite Park, but it's pretty typical of what you'll see. This is along Lake Chelan, and you can see, of course, this was a major glacier coming down through Lake Chelan, a small glacier coming down here, very nice U-shaped valley, but notice that it terminates well up on the side of the Lake Chelan Valley. So this is why we call them hanging valleys. In Yosemite, why they're marked by huge waterfalls in many cases. Here the rocks aren't quite that hard, so there's a very steep drop at the end of the valley, but it's not quite like this in terms of a classic hanging valley. If you were to get in a position where you can look on up the valley here, you would see that the basin where Holden Lake comes out, or the Holden Basin, is also a very spectacular hanging valley. We have another one around. Anybody else seen a hanging valley? There's one that's a little more obvious than this. Sure, we're looking at Copper Basin. Beautiful hanging valley right behind the village. See the classic U-shape right here. And a very steep drop, of course, from the opening of the Copper Basin area, where Copper Creek tumbles down into the valley and eventually runs on into Railroad Creek. So we have a almost too good to be true example of a hanging valley right behind the village. One sort of digressing comment, not particularly to do with the geology of the Holden area, but referring to something that most of you probably saw as you came here, assuming that most of you got into Chelan by some sort of wheeled transportation out to where Olympia is now, a little bit further south than that perhaps. We also had one that came down the central part of the state, down the Okanagan Valley, and eventually crossed the Columbia River, and then a third one that came down over the vicinity of Spokane. So we really had three different fingers of the big ice sheet that came into the state of Washington. In the Midwest, because there were no barriers, there was really nothing to hold the ice back. The ice went all the way down into Kansas, Nebraska, pretty well down into the mid part of the continent. Out here, because of those barriers, it didn't get that far. So we find that the effects of the glaciation are much less. But here's a during the ice ages, there were really two different kinds of glaciers. There were the mountain glaciers, like we've been looking at up till now, and then there were the big ice sheets, or what we call continental glaciers. And in this part of the country, the big ice sheets actually started up mostly in Canada and then moved down into our part of the country. And one of these large ice sheets came down the Puget Sound area, for those of you who live over there and are probably familiar with the fact that the big ice sheet went down about to where Olympia is now, a little bit further south than that perhaps. We also had one that came down the central part of the state, down the Okanagan Valley, and eventually crossed the Columbia River, and then a third one that came down over the vicinity of Spokane. So we really had three different fingers of the big ice sheet that came into the state of Washington. In the Midwest, because there were no barriers, there was really nothing to hold the ice back. The ice went all the way down into Kansas, Nebraska, pretty well down into the mid part of the continent. Out here, because of those barriers, it didn't get that far. So we find that the effects of the glaciation are much less. But here's a physiographic map of our immediate area. This is Lake Chelan going off to the left in here. This is the valley of the Columbia River coming in here. And the glacier came down from the north and stopped, just a little ways past the opening of Lake Chelan, and then went across the plateau over in this direction and then back up along the edge here. This had quite an impact on the state, and I'll talk a little bit more about some of this area in a talk later on this week on the Channel Scablands. But at any rate, the glacier coming down this way completely blockaded the Columbia River, tremendous ice dam, and the result was that the water was diverted off across the plateau, and this was the beginning of Grand Coulee. The Grand Coulee, and of course Grand Coulee Dam now, that you may be more familiar with, is built right at the very mouth up here on the Columbia. Once the ice melted, then the river went back into its old channel, and so it went on around the edge. But I'm digressing a little here. The glacier also blocked Lake Chelan, or the Chelan River, if you want to think of it that way. And the water then was unable to run through the glacier, so it filled the lake up to a fairly high level, and finally the water spilled over the ridge going to the south here, and in so doing it started to cut a very deep channel. That channel existed for, well, we don't know how long, and then apparently the big ice sheet pushed back up the river a little bit, or up the lake, blockaded the first channel, and the water then had to find another way out, and again it started to cut over this ridge, and it began to cut a second channel way. And again, as long as the ice was blockading the mouth of the lake, why, the water that came as meltwater had to go down through that channel. Well, again, when the ice finally melted, when the ice sheet went away, the lake and the Chelan River went back to their original channels, and they left these valleys very high and dry, and these now are the roadways that take you from, well, south from Chelan. If you come from Wenatchee to Chelan, the minute you leave the river and start up into the hills just before you get to town, you're going through one of those meltwater channels, either on the main Highway 97, which takes you into Chelan proper, or if you go to 25 Mile Creek or land a little further up the river, you go through the second channel. Both those roads follow the old meltwater channels of the Lake Chelan area. So the next time, as you leave here now, I assume most of you will go back somewhat the same way. There aren't too many ways to get out of Chelan, but notice the valleys. They're very different. They have an extremely steep gradient. They lack any streams in them now. They're not glaciated because they're not polished and striated. So they're a little bit of an oddity, and most people don't pick up on the fact that they seem to be in a kind of strange place. But take a glance at them as you go out, and I think you'll appreciate a little bit more that at one time they were probably carrying tremendous amounts of water, huge torrents of water that were coming out of the melting glaciers. One last sort of general comment about the village area, also pertaining to snow and ice, but not necessarily glaciers. If you wandered around a little bit and maybe puzzled over the fact that there seems to be quite a bit of separation from the village we're in now and the old so-called miners' village, you can see the housing area up here, and it's a fair little distance. This area was designed, or the buildings and the setting and things were actually done primarily by Swiss architects. And there were some obviously good reasons for this. They knew something about building buildings in areas where you could expect tremendous amounts of snowfall, and that's exactly what happens here. So they picked the village site and designed the buildings, the chalets and things, as you can look at them, have an obvious European flair to them. The miners' village was put up here not to keep the miners separate from, or the married miners separate from the rest, as much as it was that you'll notice a couple of really nice bright green areas coming down here. These are avalanche scars. And they're there for obvious reasons. They're there because those are places where avalanches are likely to occur in years of heavy snowfall. Well, to have built the miners' houses in that area could have been to invite disaster. And so they, being good Swiss that they were, looked around and said, you know, you can't put houses there, even though that's a nice clearing. You don't have to cut down any trees and things. That clearing is there because it's a place where avalanches have been in the past, and that means that they're likely to occur again in future years. So they built a miner's village then on beyond the avalanche scars. And as far as I know, there haven't been any major avalanches down through there, and perhaps their foresight never really bore any fruit, but at least it probably made a lot of miners sleep a little easier at night. Well, and metamorphic rocks, you actually, well, you run out of basalt right at the river as far as that goes. The Columbia almost perfectly outlines the basaltic flows, and so anything on this side of the Columbia, at least from Wenatchee north, is non-basalt. You'll find metamorphic rocks and granites and things like that, and then everything on the other side, well, once you get up to the level of the higher plateau, is basaltic material. The Columbia Plateau as such is floored with basalt, but over here it's all metamorphic rocks and igneous rocks. Well, yeah, it our best guess is that the flows actually controlled the Columbia. They probably had a lot to do with where the Columbia is. They actually pushed the Columbia off to the side, and now the Columbia just makes an almost perfect outline of the basaltic flows. Well, this part of the Cascades is what we call complex. They have a little bit of everything. They have faults. Some of them are folded. There are some of them are volcanic, like Mount Baker and Glacier Peak, and some are the plutonic rocks. So about the only way we can really classify them is to put them in the category of being complex. From Snoqualmie Pass on south, they're almost entirely volcanic. But the North Cascades don't fall in any kind of neat category. They're not like the Tetons or the Sierras or the Rockies or some of those that are more obviously from one thing or another. Well, yeah, the Olympics are kind of messy also. The Olympics are almost entirely old seafloor materials that have been shoved up, and they're complicated, but finally begin to recognize that they're a place, we look at them as being scrapings of the seafloor, that we'll call it plate tectonics patterns have occurred by the Olympics, are just simply material that's been scraped off the floor of the ocean and gradually piled up or shoved up along the edge of the plate. Very much different kind of rocks than what we see here. Yeah, and of course, some of those areas have rocks in them that were water levels were probably quite a bit higher at different times. There are, well, you get down to Centralia and through that area where the coal mines are, you find an awful lot of marine sediments along the west side of the state. So, yeah, a lot of them have been higher at one time than they are now. Well, basically, yeah. If you've seen in pictures of eruptions of Kilauea in Hawaii, and maybe, I don't know, magnify that by 100 times or 1,000 times, you might get a vision of how the basalts to the east of us were formed. Basically, they came out of cracks in the ground, just tremendous boilings of very hot fluid lava, and it, much like the Hawaiian eruptions, only on a much greater scale. How old they are? Well, no, the Columbia River basalts are much older than that. Most of them are 13 to 17 million years old, something like that. The last ones were about 6 million years ago, but most of it came out in the earlier eruptions. We don't have any, other than in the volcanoes themselves, we don't have any basaltic flows around Washington that are very young anymore. Our most recent activity has been in the Cascade volcanoes. They've been fizzling off and on for a long time, but no other activity to speak of. Well, if you had been here, say 15,000 years ago, right now you'd have a tremendous pile of ice over your head. It's a little hard to know exactly when some of the valley glaciers like these disappeared, but the big ice sheets disappeared from the continental United States about 10, 12,000 years ago. So, somewhere in that range, 10 to 15,000 years. Most of them are probably gone from this immediate area here certainly by 10,000 years ago, and I'm guessing maybe 15,000 years. Well, of course, when you get over there and look at the flows, what you see is the upper part of the flow, which is very spongy and we call it vesicular, and it doesn't look dense. If you could look down into the bottom of the flow once it cooled, then you'd see the same sort of thing that we see around here probably, just that when you're walking on the surface, you see the spongy upper part of it and not the denser part, which is down toward the bottom of the flow. So most of what the tourists always bring back, the spongy kind of stuff, because that's all they normally see. You'd have to go out into one of the valleys and look at some of the older flows, and you would see the same kind of thing we have here in those old flows, but most people don't go out and look at those. They want to see the new ones, and so that's what you see, is the really spongy, lightweight kind of thing. In the Cascades, well, they mine a little silver, a little gold, lead, zinc. That's probably been most of it. Most of the big mines have been what we call base metal things. It's hard to know sometimes how much has been taken out by gold miners, because they're kind of a quiet bunch, and a lot of what they haul out they never say anything about, so a lot of speculation occurs there, but certainly the mine here was by far the biggest single producer in the state, as far as anybody knows. But beyond copper, lead, zinc, silver and gold, that's about it. Washington is not very well mineralized. At least nobody's found very much yet by comparison to the other western states, where Nevada and California and Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, they're all big mining states. Washington, what we produce in a year. Our biggest commodity in the state of Washington is sand and gravel. Not very glamorous. But I guess you work with what you have. We have lots of that. Well, that's now the Palouse country is all windblown soil. Yeah, that's the goes back to the Scabland flooding again. Yeah, this is something I think I don't know, sometime later in the week anyway, I'll talk a little bit about the Channel Scablands and some of the geology of that area. Fascinating story. Well, came out of Montana basically. No, just western Montana. There was also a big lake up in the Dakotas, but I don't think it ever went any place. It just gradually dried up. The ones around here, the ones in western Montana anyway, were ice dammed, and when the ice dams gave up, well, then the lakes were drained very quickly.
Well, I was really stopped in California.
But
the
different ones,
yeah.
Different
stones,
I mean.
So there are single volcanoes, but the mountains themselves are the volcanoes are built on top of the mountains. Something that most people don't understand. The volcanic peaks are built on top of the Cascades.
Oh, I see.
And they're kind of a separate entity to what's in the Cascades themselves.
Oh.
So they're a little bit different. I'll try to. I'm talk a little bit about this Cascade Volcano, which is also later in the week, and I'll see if I can clear that up too. Well, thank you for your time. It's been a time.